Greater LA, KCRW show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we're taking you to a quiet block of Laurel Canyon Boulevard in North Hollywood, in front of a row of empty storefronts. Up and down here and off on surrounding side streets, about a half dozen campers and RVs are parked along the curbs. Yeah, you've seen those campers, sometimes with the blocked-out windows. Oftentimes, people are living inside, usually when they have no place else to go. Edith Grays lives in one of those campers, and on a recent morning, her electrical generator hummed as she and her husband watched TV inside.
People assume everybody in a motorhome is on drugs or alcohol. We're not. We keep our area clean. We're just trying to live like retired people.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, you heard right here on Greater LA how the city reinstated these strict rules about where and when people living in vehicles can park. If you live in a car, a van, or a motorhome, you cannot sleep overnight in any residential area. You also cannot park at any time within a block of a park or a school. KCRW reporter Anna Scott has been talking to a lot of folks who were affected by those restrictions. She's here now with an update on all of that. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
Tell us more about Edith Grays.
So she's 67 years old, and she and her husband actually used to rent an apartment really nearby in North Hollywood, and they ran a window washing business together. But then Edith's husband had a series of strokes that caused them to lose the business.
That put us where we couldn't make rent, so we bought the motorhome.
And this is how it works for a lot of people that are living in their vehicles. It's often a first step after losing housing. And for the Grays, if they lost their camper, they don't know where they would go at this point. So they do pay attention to all of the parking restrictions. They want to make sure they don't pile up tickets and eventually get towed. So I asked Edith Grays how much of her day is consumed with trying to figure out where to park.
All of it. And it's very difficult. It causes a lot of stress in my life. Today, the parking people went by, they looked at us, and because we're only supposed to be here for 3 days. But where do you move to?
So, Anna, where do people go?
Well, all different kinds of places. Some people just break the rules because even city officials acknowledge these restrictions are not strictly enforced. So many people just take their chances on getting a ticket. Others move around quite a bit, like the Grays do, trying to find places where they can park during the day. I've seen clusters of vehicles and motorhomes in industrial areas that aren't residential and don't break these rules. It's all sorts of things that people come up with.
They try and find workarounds to these rules. What about people who support those rules? I mean, you've been speaking to them as well. Are they happier with this situation now?
Well, I spoke to a homeowner in North Hollywood who does support these rules, not far from where I met Edith Grays, just a couple of miles to the west on Coldwater Canyon Avenue.
Within the last couple of years, we started to have campers and mobile homes parked along Coldwater here.
Hall has lived in the neighborhood for almost 40 years. He says the city does need rules because vehicle encampments have created parking shortages and other problems in the neighborhood.
The sanitation issue.
What kind of sanitation issues exactly? Is it like garbage?
Garbage and public urination.
But even though Hall supports the idea of rules around living in vehicles, he says these rules, because they're really not strictly enforced and because people have nowhere to go, mostly just shuffle people around.
You know, this type of thing is described as a whack-a-mole. They disappear one place only to reappear someplace else.
Ooh, whack-a-mole. That's, with all due respect, Anna, what did he expect would happen? I mean, almost 10,000 people live in their cars or RVs in the city of LA, so of course they don't just disappear.
That's a fair point. And Walter Hall says he is not unsympathetic to people living in vehicles. He says his issue is if the city can't enforce these rules, then they should provide people with safe places to park. He says he would support that in his neighborhood. And remember, the reason the city council had to vote on reinstating these rules at all is they'd expired because they were supposed to be temporary while the city expanded more safe parking lots. These are designated lots where people living in vehicles can park overnight and have bathroom access and security.
And the city was supposed to do that. Where are we on that front?
Right. So Now, the city of LA has less than 200 safe parking spaces. It's actually closer to 100 safe parking spaces for more than 5,000 vehicles, as you said, housing almost 10,000 people. So it's a teeny tiny fraction of the need. I spoke this week to Mayor Eric Garcetti about this, and he said he expects to triple the number of safe parking spaces by the end of the year.
The only way we can solve the problem on our streets is to have more spaces for people to park in. So we're going from 100 to 300 spaces. We should have it hopefully in the next few months.
300 spaces for 5,000 RVs or cars.
Still a small fraction of the need, yeah. Not even close to being enough.
And why can't, Anna, they take these, like, they have, like, city-owned properties, right? I mean, why can't they use those, the parking spots there, and open thousands of new spaces?
I asked the same question, and Garcetti said this is a budget issue. Because the city is committed to providing security at these safe parking lots, they are quite costly. He says the city just doesn't have the funds for it, although they've asked for some funding from the state. At the same time, one city council member, Mike Bonin, who represents a lot of the West Side, Venice, Mar Vista, is asking for more accountability at the city level around safe parking. Since that vote at City Hall, Bonin wasn't there for that. He has come out and said that if he was there, he would have voted no. And he's asking for monthly updates from the agency that operates safe parking for the city. He wants regular updates on how many people are taking advantage of these lots and also how they're connecting to services, how many of them are moving on to housing. He's hoping that that will help speed things along as the city opens up more of these lots.
All right, Anna. So in the meantime, if this parking ordinance is not being strictly enforced, and it's not certainly ending the problem of vehicle encampments, it's also, though, causing hardship for people living in those vehicles. What is the point of all of that if all these things are still happening?
Yes, Steve, you're reading my mind today.
Because I mean, really,
I asked Garcetti the same question. What is the point if it's not being enforced, but it is, in the meantime, stressing people out? And here's what he said.
Look, we want to make it easier, and I'm very sympathetic to that, but we also have that balance between rules that are about public space as well as making sure that it's not going to just be chaos out there. We've seen also the impact on neighborhoods, and there are more appropriate places where people can park. It's tough sometimes to figure out, but that's why we have outreach teams who are working specifically with folks in vehicles to get them the services they need and to tell them where they can and can't park. And hopefully more and more of those spaces will be completely off the street. Tripling that in the next, you know, a few weeks hopefully will help us.
So he's basically saying, yes, it's hard to find places to park if you are living in your vehicle. The city does have some outreach workers who go around trying to connect with people living in vehicles, help them find places to go. But it's tough. And even though they're opening more safe parking spaces in the coming months, it doesn't fix that basic math of a few hundred spots for thousands and thousands of vehicles. Still, Garcetti says that when these parking rules come up again for another vote early next year, he hopes that the city council will have found alternative solutions and at that point can get rid of these restrictions. But right now, it isn't really clear how they might do that.
And in the meantime, here we are moving sideways, right? Not a whole lot happening.
Yeah, and come early next year, we may be looking at another six-month extension of these rules.
All right. KCRW's Anna Scott on the Housing and Homelessness Beat. Anna, thanks.
Thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for sticking around. As you know, the city of Los Angeles is working to expand the housing supply in a very tight and expensive market. And one way they want to do it is by encouraging accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, in the backyards of homes. They see these so-called granny flats as a scalable way of building lots of new housing without disrupting neighborhoods. KCRW's Frances Anderton went to the unveiling of a test project a couple weeks back, and she joins me to share what she saw. Hello, Frances.
Hello, Steve.
We know these granny units. These are maybe former garages, right?
That's right.
Or studios that people had built in their backyards that they can convert legally and through housing codes can convert to other units.
Yes, there are thousands that were built illegally, but now the city is really pushing to make this legal. And what they did was they organized this case study, essentially, to really sort of figure out where there were some real code issues that need to be examined, red tape issues. And what they did was they put together a big team of people. It involved nonprofit Architects LA Mass, Builders Habitat for Humanity, financiers Genesis LA, the innovation department at the mayor's office, Gil Sadia's office was involved, a big team together with homeowners Trent Walby and Grace Lee, and those homeowners in their backyard built an ADU. Their home is in Highland Park. It happens to be a somewhat historic neighborhood. It is an HPOZ. It's also a hilly neighborhood. And in that backyard, they built a two-story ADU.
An ADU that's where you share the property, right, with the homeowner, and you have access to that other unit, right, through a driveway or some kind of gate.
What's really important to know is that the homeowner is the owner of the ADU. At no point can they sell off that property. This is an extension of your property. And the concept behind the ADU is that this, if you get 50,000 homeowners to each build a little house in their backyard, that is less kind of invasive, disruptive in single family neighborhoods than trying to say, upzone and put up a multi-story unit. This is meant to be the kind of low-rise, distributive way of creating housing.
We'll talk about them, what this home in Highland Park that you saw.
Well, it's darling. I mean, it's really a delightful home that the whole team came up with, led by the design team of LA Mass. Just imagine in this backyard, you've got this very cute, it's two-story, sky blue house. It's got a pitched roof, it's got clapboarding, and it somehow feels modern and traditional all the same time. Now, it has wound up being a market rate home. The rent is going to be $3,400 a month for around 1,000 square feet of livable space. The city says that's fine. They want to figure out how to enable more housing at every income level. And one of the things they were trying to figure out was simply how to make it possible for the homeowners to build. So they were actually working on a kind of a loan mechanism where homeowners can get a bridge loan to build these kind of structures in their backyard. However, they are also thinking about affordable solutions as well.
That's always good, because you mentioned this particular space, and we're talking, an ADU that's going to get $3,400, maybe even more. Who knows how much it'll get a year from now, 5 years from now, right? And so when you think about it, it's like, all right, very few people can afford that kind of money on rent.
That's right. And very few homeowners can afford what the high end of ADUs cost. What the city's looking for is to figure out how to get ADUs built at somewhere between $100,000 and $300,000. And so I recently went to another showcase, also hosted by the City of LA, or specifically the mayor and his wife, Amy Wakeland. They held an event called Engage LA, and Innovations in Support of Housing. And at that, they had a bunch of vendors kind of showing what was possible. And there I met somebody who is also working in the sort of ADU space, but her concept is to use modular, mass-produced building. The company's called United Dwelling, and the spokesperson is Monique Brandon.
Our CEO likes to say that we are the IKEA of building, our studio apartment, our studio homes, because we have a model and we fit it inside of a homeowner's garage. So it's really the mindset, that's what allows us to keep everything low. So if the cost to build it is low, then so is the cost to rent it to homeowners.
It goes inside.
I know. Isn't that interesting?
Wow.
Yes, you plop it in. So, and
that is so LA, isn't it?
It is LA. I mean, actually, funnily enough, there's quite a lot of modularity in housing that we may not necessarily be aware as being sort of mass produced offsite. But anyway, so yes, so Monique Brandon and her company United Dwelling, this was one of several vendors that were at this showcase hosted by the mayor. And prefab and mass produced solutions are definitely being held up as a means to, again, circumvent some red tape, cut costs that accrue when you try and build housing in LA. When I went to the cute little blue house in Highland Park, I spoke with Mayor Garcetti about kind of the definition of innovation as it applies to trying to enable housing in LA.
Absolutely. We want to bring the price down, and we see a lot of inefficiencies. Sometimes it's City Hall, sometimes it's the model that builders use, sometimes it's the architecture itself. People want really good design, but they want it to cost a reasonable amount.
And this is already happening, right? We're already starting to see a lot of these popping up in backyards all across LA. Sounds like we're going to continue as the costs and the red tape go down.
Yes, prefab, mass-produced housing. This is definitely an area that is, it's both being tested and very definitely starting to flourish in Los Angeles. You can also start to see multi-unit buildings being made out of prefab. But as everyone in housing will tell you, figuring out cheaper construction methods are just one piece of the puzzle. Really, everyone that you talk to who's involved in trying to construct affordable housing will tell you about how Byzantine the whole process is from start to finish. And physical design is just one piece of the solutions. However, the good news is that there is a lot of innovation out there, and that we probably are going to start seeing sort of cropping up some very innovative solutions to building a little house.
No, certainly if the city is on board, or at least acknowledges the red tape, the bureaucracy that goes along with retrofitting these places or building or redoing these ADUs, then maybe the ball will roll faster.
Yes, and what's interesting is that the city has wound up acknowledging that the city can be the problem, which is why even Mayor Garcetti is looking to the kind of market-based solutions like off-site produced modular construction at the same time as he's also working on that ADU I described in Highland Park, which has been an entirely city-led project involving nonprofits, development money. So they're looking at the nonprofit sector as well as the for-profit sector for solutions to our housing challenges.
KCRW's Francis Anderton, who hosts Design and Architecture Tuesdays at 1:30 right here on KCRW. Francis, thanks.
You're so welcome, Steve.
Glad you're with us live on KCRW's Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiatakis. School starts soon. Can you believe it? Where has the summer gone? Well, we're probably not done with it temperature-wise. Here's a question for you. Would it be helpful to you if you had a rating, kind of like an Amazon or Yelp rating for a particular LA Unified school? That's something the nation's second largest school district is contemplating, a rating scale of 1 to 5. The idea is to give parents and educators insight into how their schools stack up. With one glaring thing, though, the system would actually rate its own schools and charters. Howard Bloom covers all things K through 12 related to the universe for the LA Times, and he joins me right now. Hi, Howard.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm well. I want to talk about who's behind this idea in the first place, rating schools.
Well, the idea was brought forward by two school board members, Kelly Gomez and Nick Melvoin, and it was passed by six of the seven board members at the time. So apparently they all liked it, but I think that some board members were thinking that this might be information about schools, but not necessarily a rating system that would sum it up into one number. However, it is right there in the resolution, and six of the seven did vote for it at the time. I think some of them are having second thoughts now.
They're having second thoughts, because when I heard about this for the first time, I think it was your story, actually, I thought, isn't this like Marriott rating its own hotels? I mean,
parents rating their own children. You can't really rate your own children, but you get the idea that it's hard to rate your own things.
Well, it is, but they thought they had a system. I mean, you know, if the numbers are the numbers, they just put out, they come up with a formula and run the things through the formula. So presumably you get an unbiased rating. And I mean, the interesting thing is, and you alluded to this in your intro, you would have the prospect of the district saying, hey, this is one of our schools and it's not very good. So is that really the message they want to send? Obviously, the head of the administrators union does not think that's a good idea. We haven't heard back from the teachers union yet. I suspect they don't think that part of it is a good idea. Now, some of this is purely informational and is just data, and it's not just the rating. But obviously, if you put the idea out there, they're going to sum up your school into one rating. That's going to get a lot of attention. By the way, there are private companies that do this already, and they don't necessarily do that good of a job. So the people who defend this, including Nick Melvoin, says, hey, parents are already turning to these inferior sources. Why don't we try to do it with higher quality information?
And with a rating scale of 1 to 5. I do want to get to the sort of formulaic part of this. Like, what is the algorithm to make this rating work, or this, as you say, information?
Okay, so if we're looking at what goes into this rating, let's take an elementary or middle school first. 45% of the rating is supposed to be based on how much you are improving on state test scores, and 35% is based on how high that score is, so not related to improvement, but absolute value, right? So that's 80%. And then the final 20% would be based on how well the school is doing at keeping suspension rates low and preventing chronic absenteeism, you know, keeping students in class. Now, at the high school level, it's very similar, but 15% of that is going to take in factors like the graduation rate and the percentage of students who qualify to apply to a four-year state college and how the school is doing on advanced placement course tests. So that's pretty much how it works. And then there's some descriptive information about the school that is not included in the score.
But again, you mentioned, Howard, that some of these school board members were like, wait a second, I wasn't so sure about this. Maybe I'm changing my mind. Are there people out there who are against this idea now?
Well, there are always people out there against the idea of summing up a school. In the story, we quoted UCLA professor Pedro Noguera, who said, we already know what schools don't have high test scores. They're basically the schools that serve disadvantaged students, and we don't want to be in a situation where we're punishing schools because they're trying to serve disadvantaged students. And I guess the missing piece here, yes, there is a very strong statistical correlation between family wealth and performance in school. Now, having said that, it's also fair to suggest that some schools may be doing better with certain groups of students than others, and we would want to know that. And is summing up a school's performance in a rating the best way to know that? I don't know. That's what they're debating.
Isn't the downfall of that, though, maybe a lot of schools get a lot of kids and then other schools get few kids?
Yes, that's assuming that parents have the means to transport their kids vast distances, and that's a challenge in Los Angeles too, especially for low-income families. But we are in a competitive school environment, and you know there are still new charter schools opening, and frankly, just the way the demographics are working at the moment, there are not enough students to go around. So presumably, people would use such a rating system to try to choose where they want to go to school within the schools that they can get to.
When would this system go into effect, Howard?
Well, that's funny you should ask that, because I asked that question of school district officials yesterday, and I got a set of very different answers, including different answers from the superintendent of schools and from a school board member. So the soonest it could go into effect would be October, and that timing is very important, because that's when parents are choosing magnet programs to apply to and other programs that the school district offers. Now, the superintendent says that there's no way it's going to be ready by then. So presumably he ought to know what he's talking about on that front. And his idea actually is that this also needs to go back to the school board for further review. But there are people in the district who apparently believe this is rolling out in October, and they may be right or they may be wrong.
Well, thanks for teaching us all about it, Howard Bloom, veteran education reporter for the LA Times. Howard, as always, thanks.
Happy to do it.
You bet. Well, that's it for today. Tomorrow, you've obviously heard of fast food. How about Fast Table? Get ready for a table-setting competition that pits some hardcore entertainers who are set in their ways. Next on KCRW, all the All the president's lawyers. Next, we're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ear. Have a great day.